WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After covering George W. Bush's tenure as governor of Texas, journalist Ken Herman is now covering Bush's first 6 months in the White House. We invited Herman to talk with us about how President Bush compares with Governor Bush. Herman is reporting for the Austin American-Statesman and Cox Newspapers. He's covered Texas politics since 1979. George W. Bush has talked a lot about bipartisanship. I asked Ken Herman what he thinks the president has been doing to act in a bipartisan way.
He always says there are other people up here who disagree with him, but he respects them. I was in the East Room for an event earlier this week with women business leaders, and he brought that up again, and he does all the time, that he knows everyone isn't going to agree with him. He has this line about it would be so much easier if he was a dictator and, you know, could just get what he wants done because he wants it done, but he knows that not to be the case. So he tries to tone down the rhetoric in public. You'll never hear him, I don't believe, say anything bitter about a Democrat. He will always say, you know, they're wrong, I disagree, but I respect them. He's really trying to change the tone on that. He also is, he believes some respect for the presidency has been lost around the country through activities of the previous administration. And it's very big for him to, in his mind, restore that. You've got to remember, presidency has now sort of become the family business for the Bushes, so they have some vested interest in it. And he's working at that. And it's interesting, I had a chance encounter with him, such that you can have a chance encounter with the president, last week on the South Lawn after event. And I was talking to him briefly about these many out-of-town trips he takes. This week he's in Florida at an event. He's going on the road, shopping his plan around. And he was telling me about how, you know, people, the American people seem to really enjoy the trappings of the presidency, seeing the flags, the limousines, and you could tell in his mind it was, he's glad that people see these things and are excited about it. So he is really working to, in his mind, tone down the rhetoric.
So you're saying that, you know, his public manner in Washington has been bipartisan, but his early actions have included policies or policy changes that have infuriated a lot of Democrats. For example, he reversed his position on regulating carbon dioxide, which is one of the gases believed to contribute to global warming. He undid the new Labor Department rule on ergonomics, which was aimed at preventing repetitive stress injuries like carpal tunnel syndrome. He imposed a new federal ban on federal aid to international family planning groups that counsel patients about abortion or promote abortion. How are actions like that being perceived in Washington in terms of his feelings about bipartisanship?
Well, they are perceived as what they are. They're somewhat contentious. Bipartisanship, in the Bush view, does not mean I will not do something I think should be done because someone on the other side doesn't want it done. That's not really his definition. His definition is we're going to disagree on some things, but let's try to do it in a civil manner. But I am the president. I am the first Republican president since Eisenhower to have control of both houses of Congress, albeit by the slimmest of margins in the Senate. And he does not seem willing or prone to give up any of that power in the name of bipartisanship. Clearly, in these early actions, and there are many more you could have listed on there, it's not taking us the traditional 100 days to sort of put a brand on this presidency. It is clear, what, 60 days into it, that President George W. Bush means business. And that means for him that the Bush family thinking of, in general terms, what's good for business is good for America. He is a businessman. He is the first president ever with a master's of business administration degree, and he seems to be mastering putting together a business administration here as we watch. And it'll be interesting to see how far it goes. Also this week, there was an EPA announcement of removing some arsenic-level standards in water. It's a business-friendly move. And it reflects his view that government, in general, is something that gets in the way of business. He often talks and has talked for years about government's limited role. Government is supposed to just create an atmosphere that encourages entrepreneurial spirit and sort of gets out of the way as much as possible to let people succeed and fail on their own as their talents, as luck, as the business cycles allow. The administration's take is that these are things that got in the way of business and unnecessarily so, and The final component would be there are other ways to accomplish whatever good these regulations did. So don't worry, we are not abandoning people to carpal tunnel syndrome. We are not making water dangerous. We are not hurting unions. Of course, it remains to be seen whether that's true.
President Bush is pushing for a $1.6 trillion tax cut that Democrats say largely benefits the wealthy. How is he working Congress behind the scenes now?
It's an ongoing effort. The in one way he's working Congress behind the scenes is by working in front of the scenes, by getting out around the country and encouraging people to email and write their members of Congress in favor of this tax cut. When you go out on the road with the president since he has taken office, it's very, very similar to campaign events. He is trying to build up heat out there for this tax cut, and it's an interesting process to watch. His belief is, if indeed a tax cut is proper, all Americans should get it. The unspoken second line is always, and that means wealthier people will get more back, a simple function of they pay more.
Is there any discord within the Bush administration on the tax cut or on any of the other policy changes or policy proposals?
No, they seem to be speaking with one voice. You never really know, of course. There could be some dissent. I was with an administration member last night, and we were talking about the daily senior staff meetings they have, I believe at 7:15 in the mornings over there at the White House. And I said, you know, when everyone sits down, is it just kumbaya, you know, peace, love, and understanding, we all get along? And he kind of laughed, saying, no, of course not. But the difference is more on approach, on how do we, you know, what's the best way to sell some package? What are the best words to use? But they are aligned on message. It is a great strength of George W. Bush, of his ability to get from point A to point B in his mind and ignore all the noise on the side. He knows going into any short-range fight or long-range fight, it's just going to careen out of control, but he's just going to keep sort of moving forward and ignore it as best as he can. We saw it first in his 1994 race against Ann Richards, where he picked four issues he was going to run on, and he just talked about them until everyone was tired of hearing about him, at least those of us who traveled with him and heard it every day. But, you know, you also come to realize to penetrate the public consciousness on some of this, that's what it takes, a lot of time on task. And there was a lot of noise on the sidelines and dissonance and attempts or temptations to get him off message. Never happened, just kept moving straight ahead. And I think that's what we're seeing here now. We certainly saw it during the campaign that had, you know, it was rock and roll roller coaster ride that with a lot of twists and turns, even the Bush campaign never really anticipated. But on core message, they kind of just kept moving ahead. And I think that's what we're seeing, at least in these early days at the White House.
There was an article in the New York Times Monday of this week about how President Bush has the ear of the conservative think tanks and conservative coalitions. It quoted Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform and a leading conservative strategist, as saying, "There isn't an us and them with this administration. They is us. We is them." Is that your perception, too, that in spite of talk about bipartisanship, that he is very, very close with the conservative think tanks and coalitions and really has their ear and is working closely with them?
Well, there's probably no doubt they're philosophically aligned on most issues, so it's sort of a natural marriage. But it may not be that simple. It's just been an interesting dynamic to watch on the faith-based issues front. One of his signature efforts, and frankly more so than tax cuts or anything else, could make a lasting change in federal government, the relationship between church and state, and just very important facets of our democracy. Some of the top criticism has come from people on the right, people who supported him for president, people who supported the concept and now sort of have confused some people with the questions they've asked. People like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, a Bush advisor named Marvin Olasky from Austin, and they are, it seems like, now suddenly asking what appears to be a very basic question of, you know, fine, we can move forward with faith-based and decide that religious institutions who offer social services in a non-proselytizing way should be able to compete for federal funds. And now the first question is, how do we define what a religion is or who a religion is?
Yeah, specifically something that Pat Robertson said on the 700 Club was, you know, warning his listeners that it was possible that, you know, Scientologists and Hare Krishna people could get funding from the government if this goes through.
Yeah, and that's, I would imagine, a legitimate question of where is the cutoff between what's a religion, and what I think a religion may be a lot different than what you think is a religion, and that's where you get into the long tradition in America of being very squeamish about the dangerous intersection of church and state.
President Bush's working style has been described as following a corporate model because he delegates so much responsibility. He's said to not like his briefing papers to run over a page or two at most. He's initiated a dress code for his staff, jackets and ties for men, business attire for women. He stresses punctuality. He's said to leave his office by about 6:30. It's said he expects his staff to spend time with families in the evening and have time off on the weekends. Is the staff actually getting time off like the president is, or are they picking up the pieces when he goes home early?
I can tell you from talking with some just this week that, no, there, a lot of them are putting in very long hours, some especially on weekends. Days for the administration people start early because the president likes to start early, and then I think for a lot of the staffers, they go late because there's just a lot to do. But that is his style. He is the great delegator. He surrounds himself with people he trusts, who he believes understand where he wants to go, and he empowers them to move ahead. He likes things to run on time. He despises when cell phones or pagers go off during an event. There was an event this week where the cardinal sin was committed and someone did not turn off their cell phone, and it went off during an event with Prime Minister Sharon of Israel. And the president looked to the aide who was in charge of such things and said to that aide in a quite public way, "You apparently did not do your job well." And I'd be amazed if it ever happened again, because it was sincere consternation from the chief executive on something that for some reason means a lot to him. I think, it goes to, in his mind, to rudeness and civility. You show up on time for events, you try to make them run on time, they end when they should end, and you don't have interruptions like cell phones or beepers when other people are sort of conducting business.
When you were covering George Bush in Texas, where he was governor, did you feel that with all of the delegating that he did, that he still really comprehended all of the policies being put into effect, and if he comprehended the issues in their full complexity?
Does anybody, I guess, is the obvious response. But yeah, a smaller stage again, education became his big issue, as he says it is his priority here. Very complicated topic. But in Texas, there was a feeling that he had a pretty good comprehension of education and where he wanted to go with it. And also maybe more so that he operates out of a basic set of philosophies that he thinks he can overlay on most topics and get from point A to point B, which always is his goal. And that he is not shy about sort of hiring the talent of sitting someone down on topic X and saying, here's the problem I see, here's where I'd like it to be, help me get there, as opposed to being someone saying, you know, I know how to get there. He's not shy about saying, again, about hiring the expertise and saying, here's my philosophy, someone work out the mechanics for me.
My guest is reporter Ken Herman of the Austin American Statesman. After covering George W. Bush as governor, he's covering President Bush. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ken Herman, and he's covering the White House for the first 6 months of the Bush administration for the Austin American Statesman and for Cox Newspapers. He's the former Capitol Bureau Chief in Austin for the Austin American Statesman. He's covered state politics in Texas since 1979. One of President Bush's top issues is education. How would you say he left the schools in Texas? What were some of the policy or funding changes he was responsible for as governor?
The big thing he pushed for, one of the big things, was an end to social promotion. This business of you move from one grade to the other just because another birthday has passed and maybe you are not really achieving. And it's a stump speech line we heard ad infinitum, as we heard all stump speech lines, of the question shouldn't be how old are you, the question should be what do you know? And the only way we can tell what you know is testing. And he is a unending advocate of testing. We're still seeing how that'll work out. The social promotion portion of it really doesn't kick in, I forget the year, but we're probably a year or two away from it. And what we're facing there is the potential of the way the system works of having a widely administered statewide test that if children in grade school don't pass, they don't get promoted. And at the current rates, unless some education improves very quickly in sort of a very unexpected way, there may be many, many children for whom third grade becomes two or three very difficult years. And we'll see how the public reacts to that.
Do you get any special consideration from George W. Bush because you knew him as governor, you covered him as governor?
Let me say yes and no, which now makes me a politician, I guess. It's a very interesting hierarchy in Washington. Clearly, the major Eastern newspapers who do this all the time, it's important to the administration, apparently, to keep them happy. Yes, I get some things, but in general, the pecking order works as it does regardless of who the president is. On the other hand, I do have good contact with people who worked for him in Austin for many years. It's some, indeed, who worked in Austin even before he got there and then became part of the Bush team. And they are still, you know, they will return the phone calls and they're cordial. But even in Austin, you have to remember about Bush people around him. They're very loyal people. This is not was not in Austin generally a group of great leaguers, and it hasn't been here. Now, when we start to really play the game here and it's more in their interest to be providing some information, we'll see how it works. On the other hand, there is some, when I get FaceTime with him, I've known him for a long time now. We have a cordial, professional relationship. We've had our ups and downs over the years over things I've written. In his sort of peculiar way, he has a thick skin about it. He understands that he's not going to like everything that's written, and if he worries about it, he will indeed drive himself crazy. After an event recently in the Rose Garden when my family was in town, he had gone back into the Oval Office. Some of us had lingered in the Rose Garden, just reporters chatting among ourselves. Most of them left. He then came out and saw me there and had seen my son there and yelled over to me, "Hey, where's Jeremy?" Talking about my 14-year-old son. So I went in and got Jeremy, who was waiting in the press room, and my wife, who is also a reporter for the newspaper, Sharon, and you know, he chatted with us for about 15 minutes there. It was during that my 14-year-old son chose to lobby the president on Napster's behalf, I believe, fully an independent effort. And I can, my son found out quickly he was very unsuccessful in his lobbying efforts, as the president expressed very little sympathy for Napster's point of view. I told my son after, I said, you know, 15 minutes of FaceTime with the president on an issue like that, you know, a lobbyist probably get, what, $1 million or so. I think my son went home to prepare an invoice to send to Napster, so we'll see how that turns out. But, no, they are playing the Washington game up here, such that it is of the networks and the major newspapers up here are very important, and that's who they need to keep happy. On the other hand, one of the reasons they like to travel is, same thing during the campaign, it's a way of sort of bypassing the White House press corps and getting the message out directly. And twice so far since he's been in office, he's brought in regional reporters from newspapers around the country and had them for sort of a group interview session, 6, 7, 8 people at a time. There's been two of those so far with people from papers really pretty much around the country.
Is there much of a cloud over the White House because of the Florida fiasco and the knowledge that Gore won the popular vote and by one recount would have won Florida too and therefore the election?
The administration is moving forward as if it never happened. He is the president, and they dislike when you remind him of the unpleasantness because, again, it was a very trying time for the country and, you know, in a lot of people's minds has put a cloud over it, but they are ignoring it and just moving forward.
After Clinton's pardon list was released and Clinton was criticized by Democrats and Republicans for the people who he pardoned, what was the reaction inside the Bush White House? Was there any pleasure in watching Clinton be involved in another scandal?
I would surmise yes, they would say no. They went out of their way in extraordinary efforts to stay out of all of that. Even when there was word about the damage done to the White House by the outgoing administration, the Bush people wouldn't talk about it publicly because they just want to move forward. They want to set a new tone here. We don't want to blame anybody. And it was a very strange thing. Perhaps the first attempted cover-up in the Bush White House was of things that the previous administration might have done. But no, they went out of their way as if there had been a meeting where they all sat down and said, we are not going to take any public pleasure in any of this and just move forward. I think it was a clever strategy because it was sort of had a life of its own, and they didn't need to be pushing it, and they certainly could look very magnanimous about staying out of it.
What have been some of the most difficult things for you in adjusting to covering Washington politics after covering state politics in Texas since 1979?
Incredible difference. In Texas, covering the legislature is a very hands-on, face-to-face experience. We have a citizen legislature made up of 181 members who are each paid $600 a month to do their job, and that's it. It's not supposed to be your full-time job. The legislature meets only for 6 months every other year, and you just wander onto the House floor and the Senate floor, and you chat with whoever you want to talk with, and some of them are fairly common people, as I guess a representative body is supposed to be. By the time people get to Washington, even the least sophisticated of them have some level of sophistication. The process does produce that. And it is, it's frustrating. It's a lot of effort to get relatively little, and I'm used to, just from covering a state house, just walking up to the people I want to see and talking to them and generally getting an answer. Here, you talk to an aide who talks to an advisor who gets back with you, maybe, and it's cumbersome, frustrating, and it's like... sometimes seems like journalism performed in molasses. And now some of it, again, is I'm new up here, learning the ways, learning the people. And I'm sure, though it's harder and harder to remember, when I first got to Austin, it probably seemed equally convoluted. And yeah. Also just access. When he was governor, any governor of Texas, you could see whenever you wanted because the car was parked outside, and if nothing else, you waited by the car. And when the governor, be it Ann Richards, Bill Clements, Mark White, the many governors I covered, they sort of had to get in their car to go home at night, and you could always hijack them there and see if they'd answer a few questions. I still haven't found a place at the White House where I can wait and be guaranteed to see the president every day.
I'm not surprised to hear that.
I'm glad to hear it, I think.
Well, Ken Herrmann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
Ken Herrmann is covering the first 6 months of the Bush White House for the Austin American Statesman and Cox newspapers. He's covered Texas state politics since 1979. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.